Okay, so as you know, this conference is being recorded now. And if anybody wants to, you're on mute, but you can unmute yourself by hitting *6 at any time. If you want to say something, comment, or question that's relevant to what I'm talking about, or if somebody else commented or questioned or whatever shared, then you want to talk something relevant to what they did, then, you know, of course, the same thing applies. *6 will unmute you, and then you can remute yourself after you're done so that we don't have background noise. Thank you so much. And we did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I spoke about 6 and 7 briefly yesterday. Anybody have any questions about 6 and 7, comments they want to say about 6 and 7, shares, ideas, or was everything really simple and clear about 6 and 7? Should I just move on to 8 and 9? Anybody feel like they want clarification on anything in 6 and 7?
Okay, Joe, you asked me to ask the question. For people that I've heard repeatedly for years, like my wife, can you talk about the concept of living amends as opposed to just, saying I've wronged you, I regret it, I know I could have done better, how do I make it right, that kind of thing?
Right. Okay.
It's inadequate for long-term stuff.
I will try to remember that when I get to 8 and 9. I find it hard to believe that everybody feels like they're really clear on what 6 and 7 is. Based on just the little that we talked about yesterday. But I'll try to remember to do that. I recommend that everybody who's interested in Step 6 and 7 read through the best book that I have ever seen on the steps called 12 Steps and 12 Traditions by Bill and Company, you know, the AA, Central Office, World Services it's called, I think. It's an Alcoholics Anonymous book called Alcoholics Anonymous 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. We call it the 12 and 12. Can you mute yourself to the background noise? Thank you. And excellent. Thank you. And thank you. And look at, if you would, if you know what's good for you, take a look at chapter 6 and 7. By the way, reading the 12 traditions in the back is probably better than reading most Moser's Farm, so I would highly recommend doing that as well. It's pretty darn amazing. The humility is what pours through most of these books if you read them straight, you know? And that's very refreshing because it doesn't exist anywhere else than I've ever seen. So that's one thing. The other thing is if you take a look at Step 6 and 7 in the 12 and 12, that's the first half of the book, Chapter 6 and Chapter 7, for Step 6 and Step 7, I think that you'll be Timsa Nachas. You'll find a lot of Nachas there. They're very beautifully written. Step 6 there is gorgeously explained, the purpose of the 12 and 12 book was that Bill and the AAs had suffered through a great deal of recovery and working with each other and whatever for about 10, 15, 20 years, and somewhere in the 50s, he wrote, he decided to write what we've learned so far, you know, in 20 years of AA or whatever. So, and it's beautiful. It's just absolutely beautiful. And, Hashem gave us a gift. He gave us a real gift. So the big issue with 6, I mean, as with all these steps, if you haven't heard, the way that I'm presenting 1, 2, and 3 and explaining how 1 is the engine that drives each and every one of the steps, it is the source of it, because if I'm not clear and I don't remain clear through as long as I believe that it's true, if I'm not clear and I don't remain clear on my differentness from regular people. And my that's not the main point, but my sickness, you know, what is actually the matter with me, you know, and what care I need, that I need special care. If I'm not clear on that, then I'll lose my sobriety, probably. But before I lose my sobriety, I'll also lose all of these steps, you know. So the first step never goes away. It drives each and every one of the steps for as long as the alcoholic believes he's an alcoholic. People say, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. You know, my sponsor said, how do you know? How do you know? You know? So you'll have people on the two opposite sides of the fence, you know. One will say, oi, chalila, chalila, once an addict, always an addict, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, chalila. That's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's a terrible thing to say. Terrible, terrible. Of course you can get healed from this thing. Some people, even in Alcoholics Anonymous, will say that that's terrible because they'll introduce themselves as, hi, I'm a recovered alcoholic, you know. And you know, and I have no opinion on that, and my sponsor has no opinion on that, had no opinion on that, and he would say to me, if you have a shred of humility, you're going to not be judgmental, and you're not going to be able to say that, no, I know what you are and what you need. If you were an alcoholic, you're still an alcoholic. Who in the heck do you think you are? When the big book says, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, as far as I know, it just means have the humility, please, for your own good, to admit that until you have proof otherwise, you're an alcoholic and you need special care. So the one way to check that out is with controlled drinking. You know, try to drink and enjoy it like a normal person does. Normal people drink and they don't get drunk every time. They don't hurt themselves through their drinking. Doesn't make their lives unmanageable, typically, you know. So if you're drinking, if you can resume drinking and it doesn't really make your life unmanageable, so then go get yourself to hide, you know. And the same exact thing applies, of course, with sex and lust acting out, you know, exactly. There's no difference whatsoever. Now, if you are a Jew and you consider sex and lust acting out to be a sin, so then there's an issue there. Which causes all the confusion that there really is in the guard your eyes 12 steps recovery world. you know, because, but I'm not getting into that. We talked about that as much as I could in step one, and each and every case is different, which is sort of what I discussed, tried to touch on at the beginning of this call before we started the recording. Each and every case is different. Honesty and humility are the key, and if a person's going to be honest, then all kinds of good things will happen, and a lot of confusion and immune problems and confusion and shitas and explain this and explain that will disappear. They just have to be honest with themselves, and very little explanation is needed after that, once that is achieved. Usually for a person to be honest, really honest, it requires so much pain that the BS has to find, they can finally let go of the frum BS that they're shoveling on top of all their problems, you know, and you know, and all that stuff, all the tshuva and Kabbalah and Chassidus and, you know, whatever, morality and everything is shoveled over that stuff to cover it up, and that's quite common. You know, Hashem loves the struggle, you know. Tell that to the wife who gets a disease. Anyway, so, you know, each case is different. And okay, enough of that. So I'm going to backtrack now to where I was. I should have a secretary to remind me what I was talking about. Once a person basically has this first step engine constantly running, you know, each of the steps can come to life, okay? The solution, not to our drinking, but the solution to our drinking is quit drinking, you know, just give up drinking. The problem is we've given up drinking a billion times, you know, so we're experts at giving up drinking. In fact, we love giving up drinking. because every time we give up drinking, or in our case, masturbating ourselves, or sex with prostitutes, or phone sex, or chat lines, or pornography, or whatever it is that you are doing, whatever it is that we're doing that gets our attention and brings us to this call and other places like it, that stuff we can quit. We've quit many, many times. The question is, how do we tolerate life without it? Life is unbearable without it, as we've discovered. So you have the fresh, hot off the press guys, you know, those guys say, what? No. It's not that I can't tolerate life without it. It's that I just want it so badly. You know what I mean? So if it's causing them enough pain, then, you know, let them just give it up, you know, and then they'll decide that after a while, usually they'll decide that, you know, you're right. I just can't stand living without it. That's my problem. So, well, the answer to that is the third step. You know, the name of that problem is called lack of sanity, not lack of sobriety or lack of recovery. It's lack of sanity. And the solution to that is having a power greater than yourself that can restore me, you, to sanity. And the program suggests giving our lives over. That means giving our lives over means giving our wife over the care of God, giving our children over to the care of God, giving our, whether we're rich or poor, over to the care of God, giving over whether we're fat or skinny, ugly or attractive, whether we have great sex or whether we don't have great sex, whether our wives love us or hate us, or our husbands love us or hate us, or for the women listening, whether it means whether what happened to us? I was molested, I was abused, I was this, I was that. Giving that over to God. Therapy is very helpful to be able to do that kind of stuff for many of these things. But that's what the third step is about. It's giving my life into the care of God, you know? And that means everything in the past, present, and future into God's care. That's the suggestion of the third step, okay? So the first step doesn't tell you to try to believe that you're powerless. The first step says, if you're powerless, then admit it. If you are, if you believe you are, then admit that you believe that you are, you know? Don't be afraid. Go to a meeting and say, hi, my name is, you know, like I say, hi, my name is Dove, and I'm a sexaholic, you know? And many people just say, they say, well, when I say sexaholic, I mean that when I act out, I do X, Y, and Z, you know, very clearly, you know. There's nothing to be afraid of if you're with safe people, you know. So that's what meetings are for in AA and NA and SA. They're not support groups to hear good advice in or something, or get chizuk. They're a place where you can, the ikkar is to come there and admit the truth about yourself with no fear and not having to hold anything back. That's the basic, basic point of meetings, because that passes the message on, because the message is really honesty. All the recovery comes when there's honesty. Once there's honesty, a door is broken open and a light shines in and bam, we start running, you know, in the direction of sanity and recovery. Everybody who's ever been in a meeting where someone opened up about some hidden thing in themselves that they were hiding until now knows what happens in the rest of that meeting, you know? So I know some people think, oy vey, that's horrible. If I hear him talking about that, I might go home and masturbate. Well, then you don't belong in a meeting. Wait until you're powerless. When you're powerless, then you'll give it up and you'll be all right and you can hear the truth, you know? That's how it actually works. So, so that's the first step. So the first step doesn't say try to believe you're powerless. The first step says there's no mitzvah to believe you're powerless. If you believe you're powerless, come here, join us. Admit that you're powerless, you know, if you are, you know. If you think you might be powerless, then come to us and discuss it. Tell us what you do. We'll tell you what we do. We can compare notes and you can see, are you one of us? You know, maybe you are. You know, maybe you're not. I've known quite a few people, you know, who have come to meetings and decided that actually they're not sexaholics, and they've left with a renewed respect for all the people who are there because they truly understand what they're going through, and they realize, now that I realize I'm not a sexaholic, I realize what it's like for these guys who are sexaholics, gewalt. I have such respect for them, you know? Second step, well, I spoke about that a minute ago, about return to sanity, because the problem isn't sobriety, the problem is sanity. Of course, without sobriety, there's no hope at all of sanity or of working any of these steps properly. So then the third step is, like I said before, giving my life over to God's care. My life is not an empty box with my name on it. My life is, you open up the box that has the name Shmulek on it, or Yitzchak, or Donnie, or Dove, or whoever, Moshe, or whoever you are, and the box is filled with your wife, your children, their attitudes towards you and their futures, their past, what you've done to them, your mother and how she treated you, how your father treats you, how crazy your mother-in-law is, your father is, your mother-in-law, your father-in-law, your business is gone this, your boss treats you like that, the Arabs are taking over the world, and this and that, and who knows what else. That's your life, okay? That's everything that's happening to you, and everything that exists and affects you, that's called your life, and everything you do, that's called your life, everything you have, and you give that into God's care, okay? That's what step three is about. If you really are giving your life into God's care, so then obviously you're trusting God somewhat, you know? Pretty much trusting Him. It's all about trust. I trust God. So does a person go to death and he's like dying of, he's so afraid, Gewalt, I might be going to Gehenna, you know? is that how a Jew dies? You know, is that called Yiras Shamayim? You know what that's called? That's called what the Magid Kaddish, the Magid of Mezrich, said to Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polonia is the horrible version of Yiras Shamayim. Yiras Shamayim means, that kind of Yiras Shamayim means you're afraid of God. In other words, oh, he's a God. Like, who knows what he's going to do? He's a loose cannon. He might kill my children. He might kill me before 50 because I masturbated. Who knows what he's going to do? Gewalt. I'm so afraid of God. You know, he's dangerous. Dangerous. How can you trust him? You know, look what he says in the Torah he's going to do to me. You know, deep inside, what does that mean? It means we think he's a jerk. You know, very simple. We worship him, we wear a Bnei Tam's tefillin, we do this, we do that. We are very makar on zman tefillah, but really deep inside we think that really God doesn't know what he's doing. You know, if he would only do it right, things would be better, but he needs more patience, a little more love, you know. The rules are much too strict, and, you know, there's a lot of other problems that he needs to get straight, specifically about managing my life right, because I don't trust him. And that's the truth in most of our cases. So, third step is not about putting my life into God's hands. Really, it's about, because then the step would say, we put ourselves into the hands of God. It doesn't say that. It says we made a decision to put our will and our lives in the hands of God, as we understood him. We made a decision to do that. Where do we do it? Look at step 6 and 7, or step 8 and 9. Step 8, made a list of all those people we had harmed, right, and became willing to make amends to them all. In other words, we decided we were going to make amends to them. Step 9, made amends to such persons except when it would do harm to them or others, okay? Direct amends. So why not by step 3, it should say, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, and then step 4 should say, turned our will over into God's care. We turned our lives and our will and our lives over into God's care. There's no step that says that, because that's what step 4 is. Step 4 is nothing. Step 4 is only useful if it's step 4, 5, 6, 7. Step 4, 5, 6, 7 is turning my will and my life over into the care of God. That's how I do it. Why? Because the reason that I'm not turning my will over to the care of God, the reason that I don't trust him, the reason that I think that he's doing a screwed up job and that I really can't trust him, you know, is because I have character defects. I have defects of character. I have jealousy. I have fears, self-centered fears, irrational fears. Some of them seem rational. I have, but they're all self-absorbing, and I have obsessions. I have grandiose thinking about myself and others. I have such gaiva in me that I think I should have been the best guy in yeshiva and that I should be a tzaddik. And look, Nebuch, I'm no good. You know, that's tremendous gaiva. I have gaiva. I have gaiva that when I'm driving on the road, after I think I'm no good, but somebody cuts me off on the road because they didn't see me. And I go, bah, bah, on the horn. And I'm like, wait, where does that come from? It's Viter Gaiva, because, you know, hey, who do you think you are? You know, who do they think they are? They think they're like me. They made a mistake. You know, and if they made it on purpose, then they're sick people. They're sick people. You get angry at somebody who doesn't know better. Oh no, I'm going to beep at him and teach him a lesson. Do you ever teach anyone a lesson by beeping at him? Maybe it happens one time in 100, you know, but it's quite rare. Usually the reason I'm beeping is because I'm mad, you know. I'm insulted, and I want to go, hah! To show him that. I feel like that'll make a statement, you know. You better not do that. I reinstated my dignity, you know. That's called gaiva. That's called pride. That leads to getting into arguments with your wife and your children at home, and how if you've ever been in arguments with your wife, and we'll get to this in 8 and 9, God willing, very soon, if you've ever been into arguments with your wife that ended with you saying, damn it, you always have to be right, you know, or with her saying it, then, you know, you've got pride. You know, I've got pride. Because if being right is what it's about, that means that pride is being hurt over here, and that's it. It's all about pride. It's not about being right. It's about being considered right or seen as right by the other person. It's all about pride. So I've got pride. I've got whatever the character defects that I happen to have are. They get in the way of me appreciating life, of me being serene, you know, and accepting the life that God has given me. And we talked many times about the difference between knowledge, recognition, you know, and acceptance. A person can have their leg cut off, and they can be crying in regret for their whole life whenever, like, someone says, hey, you know, oh, I forgot you can't walk, and the guy can burst into tears, you know, because he hasn't really accepted it. You know, the Gemara says, don't insult Russia because of what he used to do. He might hurt his feelings, you know. That's talking about a person who hasn't really accepted themselves yet, you know. Self-acceptance doesn't mean condoning what I did. Self-acceptance as a one-legged man doesn't mean saying, oh, it's great to be one-legged. I'd rather be one-legged than two-legged. That's not what it means. It means, very simply, accepting that that is the truth about me, and it ain't going to change. It's not going to change, and that is the way that I am. And God loves me exactly this way because, look, he made me this way. This is his will. He made me this way, you know? That's called acceptance. In the world at large, that's called being a sissy, you know? But anyway, no wonder there's so, you know, so much violence and sex and schmutz and craziness in this world. Why do you think the entertainment industry and the sports industry are huge, including the porn industry, which for the most part is not funded by addicts. For the most part, it's funded by people just wanting to have fun and enjoying it, entertainment. You know, for me, it's not entertainment. For me, you know, I don't know about you all, but when I look at porn, which thank God I haven't done in many years, I haven't had to do in many years, when I look at porn, I'm not like smiling and laughing and having a great time, you know. My mouth is dry, I'm breathing shallow, my fingers are shaking, and I'm looking around to see if anybody's there, and I feel like I'm having the time of my life. Quite serious. And getting to step 8 and 9 about the wife, most of us who are sexaholics, you've heard or will hear from your wife, God willing, one day, that she says to you, Evolve, what's the matter with you? Why does sex have to be so serious? Why can't it be fun? You're too serious about it. It drives me crazy. No wonder I'm not in the mood. You want me to do this, and you want me to do that, and you want me to enjoy myself in this. I can't enjoy myself because it's so serious. What, for God's sake, what's so serious? You know, and the Zohar HaKadosh says that Zerantin is the Makor HaSimcha for Nukveh. What do you think that means about sex? It means that Zivug is supposed to be a Makor HaSimcha, joy. It's supposed to be fun, you know, in Yiddishkeit. It's supposed to be fun. This isn't about sexual erotic pleasure. That's not the point. It's enjoying yourself. What does it say by Yitzchak, the Yisoid Hadin among all human beings, who gave his life over in a perfect third step at the Akedah, probably, and continued to give his life over for the rest of his life, which is why there's basically nothing to say about him in the Torah. He doesn't even have a whole parsha to himself, you know. And that's why Tzilas HaMincha is so short, you know. It's like, boom, Yitzchak, it's over, you know. Why by Yitzchak? What does it say about sex regarding Yitzchak? Anybody here know? Anybody want to unmute themselves to say so that I'm not the one saying it? What does the Torah say about Yitzchak and how he had sex with his wife? Anybody want to pipe in? Very straightforward.
It says,
Melville, can I say something?
No, I asked a question. Can you answer it? Because I'm going to get off topic and get lost.
Yes, I want to tell you how they had relations, right?
What does it say in the Hebrew?
In the Hebrew, in the Gemara, that says that
the Torah, the Torah. What does the Torah say? How did Yitzchak have sex with his wife?
I think it says by Yitzchak that he sported her, whatever that means.
Right. It means that he had fun with her.
Right.
He was mitzachek es ishto. He was laughing. He was laughing with his wife.
Okay.
That's what the Torah says. Yitzchak, the Yisoid Hadin, the Makor Hadin among all humans, had sex with his wife like this, having fun. It doesn't mean that he did what sexaholic men do, which is turn this way, turn that way, do this, do that. Oh, it wasn't good enough. I need to have it again, tomorrow again, and this. And they're worried about what happened last time or what's going to happen next time, and this and that. No, it's fun. How does sex become fun for a wife? I'll tell you how. When she knows that she doesn't have to do it. That's how it becomes fun for a wife. When she knows she doesn't have to perform tonight, even if it's mikveh night, she knows she doesn't have to do it. When she has to do it, the fun is reduced significantly, especially if she has to do it again and again and the next night and the next night. You know, if you got to do it, if you know, 3 days went by, my husband's going to have it again. A day went by, my husband's going to have to give it again. A week went by, my husband's going to have it again. That kills the fun of sex for any wife, frum or goyish or anything. Okay, so that's like ikker number one as far as that goes. That's what it says about Yitzchak doing that. So we take sex way too seriously. That's a big problem that we have. So fine. Getting back to where I was, step four means but step three means giving that over to God. Why don't I give that stuff over to God? Because I'm impatient, I'm a baltaiva, which means I'm lustful. Can you mute your phone, Chaver, because I hear background noise. Thank you so much. Thank you, dear. Belville? Oh, maybe he did mute. Okay, fine. Thank you for whoever you were. Thank you for
muting. Yeah, I just muted. You want me to mute it again?
Yes, could you please? Thank you, Chaver.
Yes.
Okay, so how do I give that stuff over? How do I relax about it? How do you relax about something like that if it's so important to you? Well, if it's so important to you, you haven't given it over to God. You know, if it's so important to me, I haven't given it over to God yet. You know, because if you give over something to God, And if you don't get it, it's not the end of the world. Because it wasn't yours to begin with. It's God's. That's the simple, that's step three. Why is there no step that says, we gave over our will to God, our will and our lives and our will and our lives to, into God's care? Why is there no step like that? Because that's what step 4 through 7 is. That's what it is. Step 4 through 7 is the only hope that any of us are going to have any chelik of step 3, which we will never do as long as we are alive perfectly. None of us will. That is as much a guarantee as once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, you know, which is obviously not a guarantee because who in the heck are we to know? You know, you might be healed. Who knows? You might be healed, and the proof will be, are you able to drink alcohol responsibly for the rest of your life, you know, for a significant period of time at least, you know what I mean? For you know, whatever. Are you able to, after that, drink alcohol like a normal person can? Enjoy it and move on, you know? Or do you get drunk and it makes trouble in your life and make your life unmanageable again, you know? If so, yes, you're still an alcoholic. Same thing here, you know, with the lusting. If you can go back to the schmutz, and it doesn't become a cycle again at all. It doesn't become a cycle again, you know? So then you're okay. If it doesn't lead you to lying and hiding again, it doesn't lead you into a double life again, okay, fine. Maybe you proved it, you know? I'm not condoning it. We're from people here. But you know, that would be the only way to know, for sure. For sure to know, you know? So, okay, fine. So step four is how we open the door to doing a step three, to really giving our lives over. You can say a third step prayer, which we said here before, but that's just a prayer, you know? You also need action. What's the action to make it come true? Step 4, 5, 6, and 7, letting go of my resentments to other people that are based on my pride, my fear, jealousy, etc. Letting go of my jealousies. Because it's in God's hands. It's God's. Why should I be jealous? If I really am jealous, that proves that it's not God's to me. It should be mine. You know? So how do you do that? How do you do that? Give up. You know? That sounds crazy. First of all, I would say to somebody who feels that way, which you should if you really look at this stuff and see what the book, what the Goyim and AA are saying, you should say, that's crazy. A madrega like that, you're talking about like Yaakov Avinu or Rabbi Akiva, Gevalt. But alcoholics do it. They don't do it perfectly, but alcoholics do this stuff. How could that be? Gevalt, you know? Well, let me ask you, what are you thinking about when you say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad for the past, you know, 15, 20, 35, 45, 50, 60 years of your life? What have you been thinking about when you've been saying all the tefillahs that talk about how Hashem, it's yours and this and that, you know, and I trust you in this? You haven't been honest. So that's fine. It's time to just admit that, you know, and have a perspective like a check, you know, a quality check. What's going on with me? Just because you do a quality check doesn't mean, and you admit to yourself that your Yiddishkeit is really, you're not Tocha Kibaro, doesn't mean that you should take a yarmulke off and throw it off the next building. I'm saying, but it will lead you and me more closely to a balanced path. I gave that example before. I got into a frenzy of like doing things keminagari, you know. Once I was doing this keminagari, that keminagari. I came to shul late, and I'm putting on my gartel, and I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And I thought to myself one day, you know, yeah, the Arizal used to do this, the Arizal used to do that, but look at this guy standing over here next to me wearing a red checkered shirt, you know, and no jacket, and his talus isn't over the tefillin like some people's minig, according to the Arizal, do, and this and that. We're not even wearing a talus over his head, which the Mishnah Berurah says you're supposed to do, give out, and I'm judging him. And then I realize, 1 second, he came to Shacharis 10 minutes early. And come to think of it, every day I see him come 10 minutes early. You know, the Arizal's minhag was also to come to shul on time. That's interesting. I thought the Arizal's minhag was only crazy stuff, like dipping into a 36-degree mikveh that's flowing through a mountainside that he cut out of the rock, and saying things with yichudim and this. The Arizal's minhag was also to come to Shul on time. The Arizal's minhag also, all the Sfarim say, was not to utter a single negative or critical or judgmental word to anyone in your family all Friday afternoon and Matzi Shabbos, which are the two times that kapdanus comes out in people. Ritzvi Meyer talks about this kiseder. By Pesach cleaning, if you look in the units that Ritzvi Meyer has in Divrei Chizuk on Chumash, he talks about Pesach cleaning, Pesach cleaning, Pesach cleaning. It's a Yetzer and it's this and it's that. And then he has a disclaimer every time, and it's a long shtickle. It's not just, he throws it in. He really explains it at length. Don't get lost in the hakpadis on Pesach and the kashrus and the cleaning and this. Be a little more makbid on not being a kapdan on your family and your children and your wife during Pesach cleaning and Pesach. You know, if someone drops a fork and picks it up and puts it on the table, don't go crazy at them. You know, pick it up off the table quietly and walk away and explain it to them when there's nobody else around so they're not embarrassed. Don't go crazy. If someone traipses up something, you know, with chametz, don't go out of your mind. You know, because you lost your esrog, you should also lose your shalom bayis. You know that story with, they tell it on two different tzaddikim, but, you know, you should lose one thing because of another. You know, because someone is makil in my house in something, I should be makil in kavod habris. It doesn't make any sense. So I'm making it sound like a religious issue. This isn't a religious issue at all. This is a fourth step issue. And how do I do that stuff? If you're an addict, you know you're powerless over lots of stuff, mainly your drug and your life, you know? Not everything in your life, but you're powerless over managing your life. God manages all outcomes, obviously, for everyone. I know I'm powerless over outcomes. All I can do is try. The outcomes are always in God's hands. So, you know, what am I surrendering? Well, I'm surrendering my character defects so that I don't get carried away and start acting like I'm the boss and it should have gone this way. If God's will clearly was that it should have gone the other way, you know? And that kind of stuff happens through, and I know someone wants to say something because you're off mute, so just give me about 10 more seconds. So the process is, step four allows me to see my character defect. When you get to that fourth column, if you really believe that it's true, that this defect of my character is the only reason that when such and such happens, or when she does this, or when he does that, or when I remember that I'm like this, or that this happened to me in the past, or when I think about the future, da-da-da, it drives me crazy. It's only because of the character defect, not because she did this, or he did that, or circumstances, or anything. It's all me, that's why I feel this way. Then you can surrender, then you have hope that things will be okay, because you can surrender that if you're willing. In step six, we can become willing. Step six says you can become willing to surrender a character defect. I can do that. If I become willing, then in step seven, I can surrender it, you know? And in step seven, I surrender my defects of character. And I say, God, these are my defects of character. You know, I've listed them and I've shared them with another person. That's step five. Step five means I wrote out all my defects of character and I accept them so much that I'm not even ashamed of them. I'm not so ashamed of them that I can admit them to a safe person. You know, if you can't admit it to anybody, and no, it's between me and the Ribbono Shel Olam, that means you probably haven't accepted it. Because if you still have to hide it, except maybe just to one, I can maybe be meramez a little. That means you haven't accepted it. That means you're still ashamed about it. If you're still ashamed about it, you don't really accept the way you are. You see it as, you know, a pagam, a problem, and this and that. No. This is the way you are. This is the way you are, and God knows that. And he's being taken care of, this man, this woman, whoever you are, with these exact problems since you were born. And he will continue to do that because he loves you. Read Toma Devora. You know? And it's time that I came in line with his will, and I let go of my character defects so that God, with God's help, if he removes my character defects, I can actually be satisfied with his will for me, and I can finally have a third step. You know, not a perfect one, because I won't surrender all my character defects, because I don't even know what most of them are, because we don't have that much honesty. We only have a little. Like it says in the end of the AA book, we realize we know only a little. God will constantly reveal more to you and to us. You know? That's what life is. The way Chuck C. describes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 is a journey of uncovering, discovering, and discarding. And the more we discard, the more we get rid of ourselves, meaning our ego, the more we get rid of ourselves, we get out of God's way. That's called an aspaklaria hameira. You know, and I explained this before. An aspaklaria is a lens. Moshe Rabbeinu was called an aspaklaria hameira. You know, and all the other Nevi'im, including Aaron, all the other Nevi'im were considered aspaklaria she'ena meira. And the Mefarshim explain, what's the difference between an aspaklaria hameira and aspaklaria she'ena meira? If you know about glass in biblical times, a lens that's me'ira is a lens that's clear, because they had very dirty, unpure glass in those days. Look at the old windows, even not the stained windows, just any window. The reason that they have stained is because they're so mixed up with goo anyway that they might as well make them a color, you know what I mean? So, besides the fact that it's beautiful. But an aspaklaria hameira means a clean, clear one. It's clear. So clear that when you look at the lens, you don't even see the lens. You just see what's on the other side. And who was an aspaklaria hameira? Moshe Rabbeinu. What was his unique character? What was the one unique characteristic of Moshe Rabbeinu that we know for sure? He was an anav mikol adam. That's the one unique thing about Moshe Rabbeinu that we know. No, not b'chol beisi ne'emon hu. In every door there at tzaddikim that are b'chol beisi ne'emon hu, maybe, who knows? But an anav mikol adam, that's Moshe Rabbeinu and only Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's why he was an aspaklaria hameira. He got himself and his ego out of the way. And that's what the steps lead us to, getting ourselves out of God's way. As the Kutzker said, where do you find God? Where's the only place you can find God? Where people let him in. How do we let God in? By getting ourselves out of the way. You know, which, by the way, is with another Kutzker thing. He said, "Emes me'eretz titzmach." The truth will sprout forth from the ground. You know, the Kutzker says, "Where does truth sprout forth from the ground?" And he said, "Wherever you bury sheker." If you bury the sheker, then the truth will come out. You know, getting rid of my ego, getting my will out of the way, allows God's will to shine through. And that's step three. And that is done by 4, 5, 6, 7. That's how you do step three. Before anybody else comments, I just want to throw in one more thing. That the hook, the keres, the little hook, like the keres in the Mishkan, that connect step 4, 5, 6, 7 unit to step 8 and 9 and 10, of course, is very simple. Most of these things that I'm getting my ego out of the way from, that get in the way of my usefulness to God and others, and make it impossible until I get them out of the way with God's help, until God helps to get them out of the way by removing them. Until that point, what are they doing? They're causing conflict between me and people. You know, when I'm dissatisfied with people, I'm mad at people, I'm angry about things that they've done or things that they are not doing or things that are that shouldn't be or whatever, or angry at myself or angry at God. If you think God can't be on your fourth step, then you don't believe God's a real person, like a real entity, you know? if it's all a shita, well, I'll pee the emes. God technically can't be on my, because how is God going to remove a defect, a resentment that I have against him? And it's like, I thought he was a kol yachol a minute ago, you know? So obviously you're just not taking him seriously, that's all. You don't consider him really, really real. If he's real, you can hate him. If he's not real, you can't hate him because he's just a concept. So obviously he belongs on your fourth step if you really have a resentment against him that you really believe is against him. Half the time when it's a resentment against God, it's really a resentment against people. But that's okay. But sometimes it is, clearly. So how do you get all this stuff out of the way if it leads to so much conflict? There was conflict between you and all these people. Chances are I hurt people because of all this conflict. Or he hurt me and I hurt him back. Or he hurt me and I've hated him my whole life as a result. And I've done some things wrong to him, you know, or I've said lashon hara about him, or I've cheated him or disrespected him or whatever. There are a lot of situations in the fourth step that clearly involve conflict between me and another person. And when I do my fourth step, I realize my part in that conflict. That why does he drive me so crazy and keep getting into arguments? It's very simple. It's because I have character defects. So clearly I'm going to have to make amends with that person. If I'm really, really letting go of my resentment because I'm letting go of my character defect, which is pride, which causes me to get angry at that guy in the first place and sometimes hurt him, the only proof of that, really, to come to the fullness of that, the only way I can do that is to ask this guy for forgiveness for my part in the conflict. Oy, what a dishonor. That's eight and nine. That's how eight and nine go this way. Now, eight and nine is not technically asking for forgiveness, because nowhere in eight and nine do you ask the person to forgive you. Eight and nine, we ask that the person just hear us out, and we admit to them, I wronged you in such and such a way, and that was wrong. And if there's any way I can make up for it, please let me know. That's it, you know. When it would do harm to them, except when it would do harm to them or others, you know. So there are times when making amends to somebody will do harm to them. Every case is different. Let's say you beat your child when he was an infant, you know, because it drove you crazy and you smacked him around when he was two and running around grabbing things and driving you crazy at the supermarket. You smack him and this and that, or you didn't, because, you know, the Kubidik were yidden, we can't do that. But when you got in the car, you buckled him into the car very hard and he was frightened, because guess what? You're a giant monster and he's a tiny pizzula. And he's scared to death, just like a Christian guy on his knees with his hands tied behind his back in an ISIS execution squad. He's scared just like that. Oh, my God, this, who knows what this guy's going to do? He has no clue. So you know what you did. But he's now seven, and he doesn't remember what you did when you were two. What are you supposed to do? Say to him, you know, when you were two, I once scared the living daylights out of you by smacking you in the face and this and that and locking you in the car seat and ignoring you and whatever. Is that what you're supposed to do to your child? Is that making amends? That's going to harm him. It's not going to shame you. It's going to harm him. Now, most of us say, oi, it'll harm them, but really, it's a lie. It's a lie. Really, we're just ashamed. You know, most guys who say, oh, but I can't tell my wife. I can't go to meetings because I can't tell my wife. Why can't you tell your wife? Well, I can't tell my wife because Nebuch, the poor girl, she would go crazy. And this, no, you don't know my wife. And you know what? There are cases where it's true. And, of course, everybody thinks they're the case. But guess what? 50% of the time, at least, the only truth is, that they're ashamed. That's the only reason why they don't want to tell their wife. Because when you go through all the reasons and everything, and it comes out perfectly, perfectly crystal clear that their wife will not divorce them over this, and the chances of that are so low, it's ridiculous, and the lying is the bigger part of it, and if he tells the truth, his wife will actually be relieved that he's not lying to him anymore, and every case is different. There are many cases where he shouldn't tell his wife just glot like that, but he has to have, you know, a therapist or some support and advice from other people. We don't, like, go telling our wives immediately everything. Every case is different, but it should be discussed with someone in detail and clearly before making a decision one way or the other, you know. But usually all the excuses are just excuses. As they say in Yiddish, they're tritzim. That's all. Tritzim. They're just answers that you need to have an answer, you know, an excuse. Because the real reason, the only reason is, I'm ashamed that, you know, so, anyhow, okay, so how do I make amends to a person like that? How do I make amends to my wife for all the abuse, all the sex, stretching her and arguments with her over what? Over who's right, you know? Child-rearing arguments that really were just obviously arguments that were being fed from the argument we had yesterday about something else. It was just ego and me trying to win something, you know? It was anger at her and trying to prove her wrong. How do you make amends for that? So you make a direct amends in a case like that. With an adult, you hurt them, you make amends. I made a direct amends with my son for the things I did to him, arguments and yelling and hitting and everything. I made a direct amends to my oldest son twice for the things that I did to him when he was an older child that he remembers vividly, I'm sure, you know. But how do you make amends for everything else? And now, is my amends done to my son? Is that amends done? How do you make amends for years of hurting somebody? You say, I'm sorry, you know. It's a direct amends, but it's not enough. You have to make it right. How do you make it right? By groveling for the rest of your life? You know, is that make it right? In other words, now you're punishing them by turning them into your executioner. That doesn't make it right. You make it right by giving, by many things. One thing is giving them the benefit of the doubt when they do something wrong. You make it by doing the opposite of what you did in the past, letting them win an argument. In fact, letting them win every argument. Of course, every case is different. You have to, you know, you're talking about child raising and in a relationship, it's very easy to migrate out of a living nine-step amends into codependence. So every case, that's why you need a sponsor in recovery who has been through this already, and you need a therapist very often, you know, to help with this stuff. If your wife screams and yells, you know, at you because she's out of control, angry and stuff, part of making a living amends is sitting silently. Now, if all your time in the past, you always sat silently because that's the kind of man you are, because really you're just hating the guts out of them, you know, then you're not doing, that's not the amends. Sorry. But if you used to argue back all the time, then the amends now is to just shut up, you know, to shut up. And when things are quiet, Talk over the situation with her. Let her express her emotions, and then talk later when you can. Talk, you know? You might have to, very often we do, have to talk with someone else before we talk with our wives because we're so freaking mad that we're going to tear her head off. So you're not going to succeed in making a living amends, behaving differently, if you don't talk with a wise friend whose main wisdom is that he's not you, beforehand. Got to talk it over first. Get my head straight. I got to do that all the time. One of the ways that I make amends is by not telling my wife that I'm coming home from work before I actually left, because it might take me another half an hour to leave, and that drives her crazy. So I don't do that anymore, even though it hurts, you know? I want to call her, you know, earlier and let her know, because that's the way that I am. It's silly. It's a fantasy thing. The earlier I let her know, the better she'll feel, even though I don't get home earlier. But she'll be feeling better for half an hour until she realizes that I'm an hour late. That's a living amends, taking responsibility, being honest. The main thing that we did to our wives with our acting out is dishonesty. So we start being honest. You know, and my wife had to teach me what honesty meant, because I did not know what honesty meant before. I did not know. I did not know what honesty meant before. Once I was two blocks from home, once I was three blocks from home or so, and she said, "Where are you?" Well, we were on the phone. I said, "Oh, I'm on the street." I could see our street from the red light I was sitting at, and she says to me, I'm outside the front of the house. I don't see you." And I said, I can see where our street is. She said, I heard it in her voice, and I realized I wasn't honest. I had no clue that that's what honesty meant. You know? Anyway, I'm sorry, I was muted for a few seconds. Did someone say something? No? Okay. So one is being honest for a change, to a fault. Honest to a fault, you know? It doesn't mean driving her crazy with my honesty, but learning, being open-minded to learning what she considers honesty, you know, what's honest to her. You know, and that's something that we professional liars have to learn with practice. We just can't do it automatically. We can't figure it out on our own, you know, no matter how big and smart we think we are, which we always do. We've got to be very, very humble here, very, very humble, and try to learn, be open-minded to learn. And that's a big part of my amends. It's very hard for me to be humble, and it's very hard for me to learn, you know, so I don't have the deck stacked in my favor exactly. So, you know, but it's working. It's working. When it comes to sexual demands, go to sleep without sex. Learn how to go to sleep without sex frequently, you know, because we didn't learn how to do that before. You know, before, we waited for people, we demanded people to please us, we waited for people to please us, and we were upset when they didn't. You know? Now we can do differently. Now we can say, "Oh, you're not in the mood tonight, honey? That's great. You want to sleep in bed together? I'll just hold you tonight." You know? "Oh, okay, I'd like that. I really would like that. I'm so happy, Shimon, because until now what you've been doing is, if we can't have sex, you say, then please stay away from me. I might have a wet dream chalila, or an erection chalila, or this or that, and then you treat me like I'm a nida, you know, and now you're showing me that you love me, and that really means a lot to me. Thank you. This is a real gift you're giving me." And then let's say in the middle of the night, you wake up with an erection and you say, "Gewalt, I got to get out of this bed." You know? You get out of the bed and you go sleep in the other bed. You know? Or if you don't want to do that, you ask her if she'll go to the other bed, okay. You know? But she sees that you're trying. You know? You know? She sees that you love her and that you're trying. That's making amends. You know? Let's say before you weren't makbid on Hilchas Nida. I meet some guys who are really not makbid on Hilchas Nida, you know? And you start being makbid on Hilchas Nida, not passing things to each other when she's a Nida. Believe it or not, there are a lot of firm women who feel like, you know, that's respecting me. When you respect my body, and you say, oh, you know, if you're in need of this, then I'll treat you the right way. To them, that's respecting. If they're getting dressed and you run out of the room, that's retarded, you know? But if you say, you know, say to them, oh, excuse me, you're getting dressed, honey. I'll be back in a minute, okay? You know? They feel like they're being respected. You know, you're respecting their modesty. You're respecting their you know, body. You know, there's different ways to do things. Those are ways we make amends. That's a living amends. You know, whereas before we were like trying to get her shirt off and, you know, feel her and this and this, like she's a piece of meat. You know, things have to change. You know, arguments where you have to always be right. Let her be right. Let her be right. Shut up. And then talk with someone else about it at length, instead of having to figure it out with her. Talk about it with someone else at length and see if another person has the ability, they usually do, to notify you and enlighten you as to her point of view. No, that's new for people like me. I never thought my wife really had a point of view. I thought she was just, you know, whatever, you know. So that would be making a nine-step amends. That's a living amends. If you wasted a lot of time at work, coming in for a day and not charging for the time, taking a day off vacation and then working that day anyway for half a day, you know. You can make up for money that you wasted looking at schmutz by doing that. You know, staying overtime, if it's safe for you to stay overtime, staying overtime and not resenting it, you know, working with a smile, putting in more than better quality work to make up for the time you waste, that kind of thing. You know, those are all living amends things. And 10 is just a continuation of that. Tomorrow, God willing, we'll finish up 11 and we'll have a question and answer session. Okay? I got to run. Shalom.